Everyone, I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from Gadigal, Sydney.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast, where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. You can get this wonderful program, along with all the fantastic reality TV content, by subscribing to robhasawebsite.com/rahapupsfeed. That's RHAPUPS feed.
We would love it if you would subscribe to our feed as well. Please go to robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. You'll get your true crime on Tuesdays. If you've already subscribed, thank you very much. Last week, we watched What Jennifer Did with Rebecca Lavoie. Sarah, what did we watch this week?
This week, we watched The Jinx Part 2 on Max. It was directed by Andrew Jarecki. He's previously directed Capturing the Freedmans, which I think is fantastic. The scripted film based on Robert Durst's story, All Good Things, starring Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst. I have a slightly different opinion of that thing. And of course, The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, a six-part series which came out in 2015. This part two, is also six episodes. The first episode has dropped, and that's what we'll be reviewing today. Oh, brr! Oh, why am I feeling a chill all of a sudden? Yes, it's our very special guest, cold case investigator, Sarah Kalin. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the scene.
Hello, fellow Sarah with an H, and hello, Mari. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we're so glad to have you, Sarah. I don't know how we keep finding Sarahs to have on this show.
Oh, yeah.
Solid name. I have no arguments, as long as it's spelled correctly.
So. Yes.
So, Sarah, you're new to the scene, certainly not new to true crime. We usually ask our guests, what's your true crime origin story? And what we're talking about there is, how did you start watching it and why do you watch it and all of that? You come to true crime, let's say, honestly. Could you take us through your experience briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. Although I would say, I mean, my experience is that I am approaching my 26th year in law enforcement or investigate, like some capacity. I started initially very briefly in federal law enforcement, then went municipal and was just a regular, you know, third shift cop driving fast and yelling at people in the middle of the night. And then went into sex crimes investigation. And then eventually left that to go into academic research. And now I work as a cold case homicide investigator on cases that have what we call serial features. So yes, that does mean that I'm often working on cases that may or may not, but look like they may have been committed by a serial offender. And that is the bulk of the work I do. Although I also, through some weird machinations, partly due to true crime, have started doing a lot of innocence work as well. You know, I say from jump that every single wrongful conviction is a cold case. And so, you know, through the course of some true crimey stuff, I ended up working as an investigator on one of Rabia Chaudhry's cases for Undisclosed. Oh. She and I fell head over heels in friendship love with each other almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And I've been working on, you know, she and I have been working on cases together since. But in all honesty, I came to investigations through true crime. Through media presentations of crime, essentially. So from the time I was 6 years old, I've been fascinated by and obsessed with crime discussion in the media. I was the same age as Adam Walsh when he disappeared and then was ultimately found. And like, as a little kid, I remember that being the first thing that like really landed with me on the news. And I just kind of got more and more fascinated. And then I grew up in Gainesville, Florida, where the University of Florida is. Yeah. And so I lived through the years when Bundy was our neighbor down the street and we were all just like constantly waiting for him to walk out the door again. And then almost as soon, I was a freshman in high school when Bundy was executed. And I found out, we all found out on the day of, that one of the electives teachers, one of the history teachers at our school, was actually a minister who was absent that day because he had been with Bundy all night, the night leading up to his execution. And when he came back to school the next day, you know, it's a very like progressive school and the students basically revolt and they're like, we're not doing anything until you talk to us about this. And so he kind of opened the floor to questions. And I remember everybody asked some version of the same question, which was, why would you do this? Why would you, you know, we've all been living in fear of this man, you know, the whole country lives in fear of this man, and you go help him, you go help him. And I remember thinking, like, if the guy's a minister, that's why, you know what I mean? Like, this doesn't seem like a question to me. And I remember the question for me is, why is he like that? What makes him this way, that he is so different and so like there's just this type of mindset that most people can't recognize? And that question, I just never really stopped asking that question. But it was only a year and a half later when Danny Rowling hit Gainesville student murders. Yeah. And so, you know, I lived through that summer and through like everything we were going through as a community. I was 15 that summer. And I think it's pretty easy to understand why I was like, you know, at some point I was in professional theater as a kid and I originally went to a conservatory for theater. And at some point I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I want to go chase serial killers. And
yeah,
so that's what I started doing. Or that was
the Gainesville Ripper. Wow. I know that had to be terrifying, just terrifying. Thanks, Sarah. I am like blown away by your experience and expertise. And I am so glad to have you here to talk about this property that I know is going to be, we're going to be here. We're going to be talking about it.
Yeah. For
sure. We sure are. I mean, there is, you know, potentially question mark, allegedly, possibly a serial flavor to Robert Durst beyond the murders that people associate him with, shall we say. So let's get to the crime or crimes. Robert Durst came from a rich family involved in real estate. Sort of an understatement. I didn't know quite how else to put that. In 1982, his wife Kathleen disappeared. In 2000, his close friend Susan Berman was murdered. And in 2001, his neighbour Morris Black was killed and dismembered. In 2004, Durst was tried for Morris's death, but was acquitted. The jury believed he had dismembered Black's body, but not that he had killed him. Durst was sentenced to 5 years in prison for bail jumping and tampering with evidence. Durst was convicted of the murder of Susan Berman in 2021 and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And during that trial, the disappearance of Kathy Durst was reclassified as a homicide, and shortly after his conviction for Susan Berman's murder, he was charged with Kathy's murder. Durst died in January of 2022. So let's get to the property. First of all, the first six episodes of The Jinx aired on HBO in February 2015. Robert Durst was arrested for the murder of Susan Berman the day before the finale aired. Andrew Jarecki had given John Lewin, LA Deputy District Attorney and Dateline regular, access to his interview tapes with Durst, including the hot mic recordings of Durst alone in the bathroom. In the documentary, Durst appears to say, "What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." This apparent confession was edited from a longer recording of Durst talking to himself. He does say those words, but not in that order. Sarah, I'll go to you first, because you said that Andrew Jarecki actually held back the evidence, if we like to call it that, for some time after he was in possession of it.
That was my understanding, because I remember at the time that it came out, I remember this sort of flurry of rage from people who said, you know, if this is such important, you know, evidence that's going to implicate him and stuff, why would you hold it back at all? And obviously the reason is he's a filmmaker and he wants it to be a bombshell. And so it seems that he probably waited until, I mean, if Durst was arrested after the airing of episode 5, he obviously had given the evidence sometime before, because you've got to either get the prosecutor on board or get, a grand jury. Somebody's got to issue this arrest warrant and stuff in order to start charging him. So he clearly had given it to him before the episode dropped. But my understanding was that there was a fairly significant gap between when they got the recording and when they actually provided it to police as potential evidence. And that's, I work both sides of the world. I kind of understand it, but I know for me, at the end of the day, the investigation is always going to come first. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a filmmaker. I'm an investigator who happens to do true crime rather than, a filmmaker who did some stuff on an investigation. So,
Murray, do you remember when The Jinx came out in 2015? Did you watch it? Were you on it from the drop?
I actually wasn't. I it's so funny because where I was at, I was freshly in New York. We were having so much fun just being in that town at that time and it's so funny because I remember all the billboards. I remember all of it, but mm-hmm. I was just too busy living my life. It was golden. And so I didn't watch the actual 6-part of The Jinx until way, way later. I can't even remember. It's been years since I've seen the original, but I definitely felt this part 2, it revived everything I remember about the original, series. And, even though we only have one episode to talk about, I really think that it's a great first stepping stone. I'm very interested in how they are going to spread this over another 6 episodes, because I didn't keep, again, I kind of I was no spoilers, because I didn't keep up with Robert Durst. I didn't look into all of that after I knew he got arrested because of what he said on The Jinx. So I'm very interested to see how they break up this next 6, because it's okay, are y'all dragging it or what? Are you just trying to make content? But I think this episode definitely felt like the original. It felt like everything we got from the first part, and it felt updated for modern true crime tastes, I guess, if that's the right word. So I'm very, very excited to watch the rest of this season. I guess that's a spoiler alert for the ratings, but it just reminds you why The Jinx is we reference it so much in a whole bunch of our other shows, because it was one of those documentaries that was really groundbreaking in a way of now everybody kind of wants that gotcha moment. And in crime documentaries, everybody wants that gotcha moment, and that's not always good. People try for it and they fail, but that's the cultural impact of The Jinx. Everybody wants to now open that case. They want to be the documentarian that maybe shed something on the case that went unmissing, and now the suspect might be apprehended. It really feels like it added that type of feeling to the true crime genre. And then on top of that, the original series itself had everything that you would want in true crime. And it starts off with a cold case. Then you get your trial portion for the people like me who love to hear the whole trials, all the case being presented. Then you get another cold case or active investigation, should we say. And then the gotcha moment. It really was a time capsule in time of the true crime genre, and it really did take the genre to a whole different spot. So that's why this is going to be a crazy discussion. Like, I'm so excited.
So, Sarah, John Lewin says right at the beginning of this episode, if there's a door for not talking and a door for talking, Bob always goes in the talk door. You rewatched The Jinx just moments ago, the first six episodes. What were your impressions now, and how do you think your response differed from when you first watched it, if it indeed did differ?
Yeah, it definitely did. And so what I did when we scheduled this, I went back and rewatched the original one just over a period of a couple of weeks. And then I watched the new one when it dropped. And then I watched the new one again right before we came on, so everything would be fresh. And I have to say, first of all, Mari is like hit the nail on the head about like it is this moment in time in true crime. And it's an era of true crime that I kind of refer to. It's like the beginning of what I refer to now, this period we're in, is like this renaissance of true crime.
Yes.
Because I feel like, you know, people always ask the question, and I'm asked a lot, like, oh, why is true crime suddenly so popular? It's not. I do a lot of research. I do these like live presentations around the country, sort of like true crime talks. And in those, I focus on a lot of like historical cases, like Victorian and stuff like that. And one of my favorite things is to demonstrate either through like newspaper clipping or even photographs as we got, you know, into the turn of the 20th century, just how much crime has always been something. It's part of the human condition that we are obsessed with it. It also, for the record, has always been almost all women. I go back and look at these crime scene photos from like the 40s and 50s, and it's just a sea of women like staring over like, you know, the crime scene when people used to be able to get up close to them and stuff like that. It has always been a predominantly female consumed genre. But for a long time, I think because it was centered around violence, the perception by creators was, well, it must be male driven. And so they were making stuff that I think was, you know, I mean, we all love old Forensic Files. We all love old Forensic Files. I go to sleep still listening to it in the background. You know what I mean? But like that era of true crime and even like the books at that time were, there was definitely a sort of a schlock element. And it was a little bit more about the, you know, the like misanthropic bad guy and the heroic cop. And it was like this sort of formula that I think it didn't allow for it to really become true documentary and really good documentary until around 2015, 2016, when a couple of things happened and the content creators very accidentally discovered that it was all women consuming it. And so they started to bring in more female creators and started to kind of focus this content on not all, I mean, there's still some schlock out there. There's no doubt about that. But we see so much more of this like advocacy-based true crime or like, like you said, kind of getting to the bottom of it and stuff. And so, and like The Jinx is right in there. When you said 2015, I was like, it did not come out in 2015, but of course it did. Mm-hmm. And that's like right around the same time, like we get into Making a Murderer around the same time. The Staircase had been out, but it kind of had a revival. It got like a bunch of attention right then. Mm-hmm. My Favorite and Murder launched. Michelle McNamara.
The Epitome. Serial.
Yeah, and Serial.
All of that.
All came out right in that. Well, so Serial was the Patient Zero where I heard Ira Glass talk about this, that, you know, they were really pissed because they were getting these massive numbers and they were like, why did we not charge more for advertising? Because they just had so we went into the demos and that's when everybody started seeing that it was like all these women who had money to spend and they should have advertised to them. And that was kind of how we found this stuff out. All of that to say, I think that true crime now is more responsible than maybe The Jinx or even Serial was, but that stuff really did kind of birth what we have now. And so, yeah, the aesthetic of it feeling like that, and some of it, when I go back and rewatch it, when you asked this, this is all to answer your question, believe it or not. like, did your view on it change? It did, in the same way that my view on Serial has changed dramatically. But I think I think that is largely due to the fact that we've come to expect even more, like a little more responsibility, more journalism and less storytelling. Like we want the storytelling too, but it needs to be more responsible in the in the elevated stuff. And so I think that might be why I view it a little differently. I think that there's some stuff in it that if it was made now, it might have been they might have tackled some stuff a little differently. But I mean, it holds up. It really is one of the kind of, the originals in that era.
Yeah, I rewatched it as well, and I amused myself by wondering if they used the same reenactment actor to be Bobby Durst. Mary and I are on record as disliking reenactments. There's a very interesting article, which I'll link to in the show notes, on the ethics of reenactments, which we haven't even gone into, which is the whole area of re-traumatization of victims and so on. I was surprised isn't quite the right word. I didn't remember how extensive the reenactments were, and we
That
see in
was definitely a thing back then. I rewatched An Innocent Man again recently, and it is another one that is like very good and very well done, but it has that same flavor where it's a lot of the not direct reenactments that we used to see in like the 90s on old, when it
that.
was just Discovery, but it is that sort of like that shadowy reenactment. That one is all that whole era, they were doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I found in the new episode that the reenactments were more judicious.
I
They
like
go
them.
with the style, Mari. You like them?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it wasn't too heavy-handed. It felt appropriate. It wasn't too schlocky, as Sarah would say. I didn't mind the reenactments. I thought they did a really good job of, again, it felt like it slipped right into the Jinx universe, but while also feeling modern and updated.
Yeah. So in rewatching the image of the reenactor Kathy stepping onto the train, which happens over and over again throughout
That's the
six
one that
episodes,
lives in my brain.
lives in our brain. There's a couple of reasons, one of which is, was that the last of her? And then, of course, now it is strongly suspected that she never got on the train. And it recalled to me my true crime origin story property, which is The Thin Blue Line, last century. Errol Morris and the repeated reenactments that he used in that. So, Mary, yes, you talk about a freshness and a newness to this while it remains in the Jinx universe. I completely agree with you. What to you marks it as so contemporary this time, or this one episode that we've seen?
Yeah, I think what it is it still has the style of the Jinx in a sense of we're getting our talking heads, we're getting like it's so weird that the show is like citing itself, like that's really interesting to me. But I think what kind of updates it too is we were talking about it last week with what Jennifer did. The use of all of like modern, like the camera footage, like this first episode, Robert Durst is trying to flee, and we just see all of the camera footage that they have of him like getting ready to like flee and leave the country. And it's just so funny and it's so good because that's kind of what we get a lot in modern true crime documentaries and docuseries today. It's like they try and get as much of that found footage as they possibly can, even if it's like to the detriment of the property as a whole, but that I feel like is an updated modern feel. Like we said, I did like the reenactments. Surprisingly, I thought they were very well lit. They blended seamlessly from either the talking heads or the real footage that we had to just normal reenactments, nobody doing anything crazy, not too shadowy, like just normal reenactments. So I definitely feel like it's an upgrade, and like Sarah said, maybe we'll see how these other episodes go, but I'm hoping we see some more careful depiction.
Sarah, we re-meet Charles Bagley from the New York Times. He's all over this episode, and he certainly appeared in the original six parts. How did you find him as what seemed almost to be a major narrator now in this first episode?
I don't know if I have an opinion on it one way or the other yet. He definitely seems very excited to be participating.
Yes, he's
in like a real good mood the whole time he's talking. There is an element of this that feels very like dude bros patting each other on the back a lot. And so the interactions between Begley and Jarecki, where they're like actually cutting to him. And I remember that being something that like, it did stick in my craw a little bit from the first season, even like originally watching the first season. I was like, if you're the documentarian, why are you on camera so much? This is not supposed to be about you. Cause I like, I grew up in the like Ken Burns documentary world where, you know, as on Only Murders, he said, you know, it's like a Ken Burns documentary on the history of boredom. Like that I live for that. I love a Ken Burns documentary on the history of boredom. And so I found it a little jarring how much the filmmakers appear the first season. And this time I feel like we're probably going to get even more of that. There is a little self-congratulatory flavor. There's a sous-sens of look how good I am. And that between the two of them, like the fact that they actually cut to Jarecki smiling and nodding as, you know, Begley is saying like, oh, and then on your show. And I was just like, oh, Jesus, okay. But yeah, no, I mean, other than that, I don't really... I'm always excited to see a good or an investigative journalist, like an actual journalist involved in true crime documentary, because I think that elevates it.
Yeah, we love to see the journalists. I mean, I asked because I thought, well, there's a lot of him, but I'm not sure what I'm getting other than the reporting that Bob was watching the Jinx in real time. Yes. And calling him after each episode. I mean, that is interesting, but I'm not sure why he's the narrator of that. Mari, did you?
Because Jarecki couldn't say it himself. That would be.
Yeah.
He needs somebody else to say it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. And they didn't have recordings of their talks, right? No, they didn't. So they just had reenactments of the talks between the two of them. So
he must have had recordings because he's got the full transcript typed down. He's got the full transcript.
Okay, that must be it. Okay. So I mean, it was very interesting to hear Bob's takes on watching his own documentary. And I love that we got the triggering of the flight of his him trying to get away. That's what I'm saying. This whole first episode was just like the continuation of the last part where, you know, he tries to flee and they arrest him. So I'm really like, okay, so what are the next few parts going to be?
Where's the new material, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I assume what it's going to be trial, right? It's got to be the trial.
It's got to be the trial.
I hope so.
Mari, what did you think about his assistant, whatever that means, Donna?
Yo.
Going to his apartment with her husband, his friend Chris Lovell, who was on the jury in Galveston,
who was on the jury. So, I was aghast on that one. I didn't have time to go back and watch the whole series, but I definitely went back and watched episode 4. and watch the trial, the Galveston trial, and there Chris Lovell was front and center talking about his best friend that wasn't his best friend at the time. There's no way, right? Like, she couldn't have been his assistant during the trial. She would have had to be the assistant after, right?
Yeah, they wormed their way into his life.
Exactly. That feels
gross.
Not right. Yeah. Yes. And but I, man, when I tell you I love a good security cam footage. And then who was narrating this security cam footage here? It was a woman, wasn't it, Sarah?
The front desk woman, I think.
Yes. I was like, man, this lady has some great memory. Yes, she was like, yeah, Donna came and her husband came and they had empty bags and they went upstairs and they came back. And had. I was like, she is on it. I like this part a lot. And it did blow me away. And again, referencing itself, having clips of Chris from the original Jinx. I think I might want them to be a little bit more, like maybe make the type bigger about when you're referencing what happened in the past versus what's happening in the quote unquote present, because even this present is not present, you know what I'm saying? So a little bit of more of a delineation between Jinx part one, like 2015-ish to like now, which is what, still like 2016, what is it, like it's still 2015 in their present timeline. Yeah, so it's like I need a little bit of delineation, a little bit more of that, but other than that, like really fun part here. It to say the least, because he's about to put that wig back on, so
yeah, the mask, that was like, who is gonna cross a border with that mask on? That I don't understand. Like, you're
Bob
not
Durst was going to both. Bob Durst, who never thought he'd be arrested. He never thought there'd be a judgment day.
Because he's the son of a rich real estate guy. They never have to pay the price.
They never have to pay the price.
He's an underdog, Sarah.
Oh my God. Woof.
My head almost exploded when he said that. I was like, you cannot be serious.
Yes. We see some sort of almost home movies. They're not. I mean, they're made by the director, Andrew Jarecki, of the families of the victims and others involved in the case gathering at Jarecki's place for a screening of episode 6. We see Janine Piero. Where is the body? That's my
What did you do
to that baby? I can't do it.
Cecily Strong on SNL.
That is, in fact, who I am.
All I can think of is her spilling wine all over Colin Jost every news update.
When I try to do my Janine impersonation, it is, in fact, an impersonation of Cecily Strong.
Cecily Strong, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This was breathtaking. I don't know if that's the right word, Mari. Watching this group of people so involved, Kathy's brother and sister-in-law, they're laughing at points. And then, of course, the shock, which is what we all felt when we watched it if we didn't know it was coming.
Like, in all intents and purposes, and sorry if it's vulgar, this was like a money shot. You know what I'm saying? Like, you are literally there filming people who have close ties to this case as they're first seeing the quote-unquote ultimate bomb drop of that audio of Robert Durst essentially, quote-unquote, confessing on tape. Like, that was, I mean, that, I'm surprised they led with that in the first episode almost. That is amazing footage to have.
It's amazing footage, but I have to say that to me was the most offensive part of all of it.
I can see that.
Because I'm in the unique position of working very closely with family and loved ones of these cold cases, where people have been begging somebody to, you know, to look at it for all this time and stuff. And the degree of faith that they place in you is overwhelming and terrifying. And like, it's a ton of responsibility. And I cannot imagine withholding that information in order to film their response, like withholding it for that long. I can understand, because I do, you know, I am kind of also in this documentary world now, and there's like, as John Oliver says, there's like business daddy. And so like, you have to, you know, I can understand, like, if I was like recording a Zoom or a phone call or something like that, when I was updating a family member on something that I had, you know, if there was a significant development, it would never occur to me to wait months to give them that information and then to film it. It felt really gross for me. I did not like that at all.
Yeah, it wasn't naturally set up. So you're right. It's not a coincidence that they got this money footage.
No, he brought them there.
They set it up. Yeah.
And it feels predatory. I just, yeah, I was not wild about that as a
I mean, we can have them telling us, right? We can have her brother saying, when Andrew told me about it or when I first heard the tape.
Yeah, film or
He
record
can.
them at the time you tell it and make sure that they're comfortable with that reaction being shared. I just, you know, I get that in pure documentary, you know, you're not supposed to interfere with them. But I feel like in that case, you're interfering with the like naturally occurring thing. You're manufacturing a degree of shock so that you can catch it. And
And I don't know if you want to have your reaction in a room full of, like, leaving aside the filming, why do I want to have that reaction in a room full of 35 people
no.
rather than privately with my wife and my daughter, who looks
Yeah.
exactly like my sister?
Yeah. And at this point, our hope is that, you know, with part two coming out so far after part one and so far after this being actually recorded, that he still has the blessing of the family to put this on here.
Yes.
Yeah, I hope so.
So, leaving aside filming these people in that moment, you have thoughts about that recording, the so-called confession?
Yeah, it just to me didn't like if I was investigating that case and I heard that, I would certainly be intrigued by that, but it would not be the, it didn't feel to me like enough of a confession to actually move on it. Like if I was the investigator that he handed that over to, I'm not sure I would be like, oh, this is the thing I can move on after all this time. I think the Beverly letter, that is something I would bring to a grand jury, absolutely. And then maybe his interviews talking about that, where he's like denying that it's him, but it's very clear that he doesn't know which one, if it's, you know, if it's not his. That to me was much more compelling as evidence that I would bring to a grand jury or bring to a prosecutor than this kind of like, oh, I killed them all, of course. Because that could so easily, like, how does a defense attorney not just say, he was being sarcastic? He's a very, he's an odd bird, you know, he's a little bit quirky. He's a little bit of an asshole. Like, there's no reason to necessarily assume that that was not sarcastic. I'm not saying that's true. I think he probably did kill them all. But I'm just saying, like, to me, it's less of a bomb in a way than the moment when he says, you know, well, can you tell which of these you supposedly wrote? And he very like, he goes, no. Like he knows in that moment that he's caught. And so that to me is more compelling. I understand you can't run the credits after that the same way you can after. I had forgotten that that was like literally what it was, where he says, I killed them all, of course, and then it goes black. Like I was like, oh, I forgot that they did that. That was a choice. But yeah, I just don't trust that it's a valuable confession.
But
Now
it is the
we
sensational one.
It's the
It's
same
what was on all the newspapers and all the quotes. And every time somebody
five
got the quote
words,
wrong,
the
it
rule of
really
four.
annoyed me.
Me too. My dad
Yeah.
always get referred to as like they captured a confession. And I'm like, but did they? That doesn't, it just doesn't feel like a confession to me.
We have extensive recordings of Bob after he's been captured. John Lewin is talking to him. We get some interspersed narration from John Lewin now about what was happening then. I thought this was very well done. We have audio of Bob all the way through. We have some very fuzzy real footage, and we have some very nicely matched reenactment footage. Sarah, Bob says he was on meth the entire weekend. What did you make of that?
I mean, when he said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I can see it. I mean, so they're like the twitching and stuff. The what was interesting that I found, because everybody talks about all the burping, and that to me is that is the body responding to the fact that he's in a corner. That like the burping was even more telling to me than the supposed confession. I've not heard of that as a side effect of meth, but like all the blinking, all the looking around, the like the scratching and stuff, and just the sort of frenetic behavior. Like, sure, I could see it. I don't know that it, he didn't seem like out of his gourd or anything, though. I mean, I've certainly seen footage of and heard other officers talk about like people they had apprehended, you know, like actively on meth and stuff. I didn't have a lot of meth. I had a little bit, not me. In
terms we'll be clipping that one.
Let's go ahead and do that a little bit. In terms of arrests, I had a lot more, you know, cocaine and stuff like that. I did not encounter a ton of meth when I was patrol officer.
Yeah, the classic cocaine. Yeah.
Yeah, I had you know, plenty of coke, lots of rock cocaine, but not a ton of meth. So I haven't seen it up close and personal a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a case I'm working on right now, which is in a part of the country that, like, opioids and fentanyl have kind of passed them by. They're like still, they're all still doing meth. And that's interesting when you do see it out in the world, because you see it, it's just out in the world. And I don't know that it looked like he was necessarily on it, but I certainly couldn't say no way.
We're not experts, but what did you have other thoughts about that interrogation? Well, interrogation, it seemed like a very friendly conversation.
Seen
other interrogations where people have been backed into corners and they are very polite to Bob Durst.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. That's the way it should be. Like, a lot of us prefer the word interview. And it's either, you know, a custodial interview or a non-custodial interview. But interrogation to me is this Reed technique bullshit, which is how we get so many wrongful convictions, you know? And so if you can't get a person to speak with you without bullying them, you probably should not be conducting suspect interviews, in my opinion. So I think that the interview was done right. I mean, you can still nail somebody to the wall and do it in a calm tone of voice rather than, you know, pounding on tables and stuff, which is still sometimes happening, but not nearly as much as cinema would have us believe. I think what he was doing, that was a perfectly reasonable modern suspect interview.
And Mari, Bob seems to be looking for some relief. He's talking around and around, which from the first six episodes, we're very used to Bob never quite saying, never quite answering, but he talks around and around, seems to be almost saying, if I tell about Kathy and Susan, what do I get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Lewin contemporarily now with us, saying, I mean, you can imagine how excited he would have got at the idea of being told, particularly about Kathy. Mm-hmm. He realized that he would never get a confession. What did you think of Bob here? What do you think he was? Why does he talk so much?
It was so funny. It was so funny to me. I was like, this, what? Like, it's like he kind of knows what line he can, like, really, really toe. Like, he is just towing that line, and he's like, no, but what if I knew some information, what would you think I would want? And Lewin was like, well, you know, you go back to California or maybe serve somewhere else. And Bob was like, yes, something like that. I was like, what is this double talk? It was really interesting. I definitely thought it was interesting. It was the cat and mouse of it all. Bob Durst being Bob Durst, entertaining, to say the least.
I actually, it's interesting. I love hearing, like, that perspective on it. And I think that mm-hmm. is definitely true, the cat and mouse thing, because I have experienced that a great deal on the other side of an interview table. And it's always mm-hmm. a little obnoxious when it's happening. But
I can imagine.
Also, props, because, like, you shouldn't be talking to me without an attorney. Like, for the record, everybody listening, right, innocent or not, do not talk to the police without an attorney ever. But what I think is actually happening, I think you're right, he does know what line he can go up to. Mm-hmm. I think that he knows they've probably got him dead to rights on Susan. So he knows he is going to serve time. And so what he does is he begins to plant this seed that he's willing to negotiate, but he's not mm-hmm. going to actually do it when he says, like, I would ever talk to you without my lawyer. And I think at least the way the investigator kind of, like, framed it in the question was like, oh, we're never going to get a confession out of him now. I disagree with that. I think what he was doing was planting the seed so that he can now go back to his attorney and say, they're willing to work with me, because I think everybody on his team knows he's probably going to prison for Susan. I mean, maybe they can get him off, but I think that was his thinking, was I will now go to my attorney and bring my attorney in before I give a confession and let the attorney lead that so I can get the best deal.
Yeah, that makes sense to me too.
He's setting himself up for a deal.
He's peculiar, yeah. But he's not stupid.
No, he's not.
He did get away with one murder. So I don't know whether he thinks he'll never serve time for Susan. I don't know whether the opening gambit was, if I tell you about this, can I go home? I wouldn't put it past him. I mean, this is a man that stole a $5 sandwich when he had $35,000 in his car.
I mean, at one point he says, I'm 72.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, he's kind of like, yeah, I've had a great life. Because he has. He's been on the outside this whole entire time.
He's been on the outside the whole time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So. Yeah.
So, Murray, what do you think the next 5 episodes might hold? I, like you, am very curious about what it's going to be filled with.
So we end with, like, Bob's in jail in New Orleans, right? And he's getting all these, like, he's doing all these phone calls. Can you imagine just sitting in your house and, like, a suspected serial murder that you haven't talked to in like a decade and a half. I imagine the next episode probably negotiations into where he gets tried. Since you spoiled it for me in the beginning.
So,
and I know that. And I know that.
He's dead.
And I know.
I didn't realize that either. You said that and I was like, oh.
Me neither. That's what I was like. But so we do know he goes on trial for Susan.
It was in
Berman.
All the papers.
Yeah, but so, I'm like Mari. It was just like, okay, I did that. I'm not following
exactly.
It anymore. Yeah.
So I think if we're doing true Jinx fashion, then we got to follow that trial. I have no idea how that trial went. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of it. So. It'll be very cool to see it again presented in the documentary form. But I that's as much as I can think. Maybe follow the investigators when they officially turn Kathy's case into a homicide again. Maybe revisit that a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm wondering about that, whether we're mm-hmm. going to go into the Kathy side of it, because there was a grand jury during the Susan Berman trial. During the trial for the killing, the brutal killing of his dear friend, Susan Berman, a grand jury who said, yes, you can charge for the presumed murder of Kathy. It's going to be a no-body case. I actually don't know, no spoilers, because I actually don't know how far they got with that. Do you think that any of the other young women who have been allegedly in his orbit, allegedly killed, allegedly by him, do you think that's too long a bow for Andrew Jarecki to pull, Sarah?
I guess I didn't realize that there were others. I, you know, the thing for me about this one is, at least based on the stuff we know from the Jinx, I do not classify Durst as a serial killer, because a serial killer requires like no connection between the cases. And in this one, it seems to be that it was Kathy and then Susan and probably Morris Black, if he figured out who he was or something like that, were committed in the attempt to kind of cover up what anybody knew about Kathy or something. And so to me, those are like related, so they don't classify as serial. If he's got, I didn't realize, maybe I missed it somewhere, that there are like other women who potentially went missing in his orbit. Then yeah, that's a whole different thing. And I was excited to see at least that the cold case investigator they've brought on, that he specializes in nobody cases. They're hard. They're really hard. And they're like even harder to prosecute than they are to solve. And so I'm excited to see what that guy's able to work up on Kathy's.
Yeah, I doubt that it will. I doubt very much that it will come in. It's kind of scuttlebutt, and it's easy to pile on more bodies, as it were. Sarah, I think that's a very good point, that if the initial and first murder was Kathy, then he killed Susan Berman because she was saying, give me money or I'll tell that you told me that you killed Kathy. Mm-hmm. And then Morris Black figured out who he was, because he was on the run. So really it's all involved in the same case.
It would not be classified as serial.
Yeah. So based on this first episode, how many magnifying glasses are you going to rate The Jinx Part 2, Episode 1 out of a possible 5, Sarah?
Oh, God, you're putting it to me first?
Always.
3. The archival that they have, and it's the archival that is the big thing right now. That's what, like, working in it, trust me, that's all anybody wants now is, you know, is the archival, the stuff from the police interviews and the, you know, courtroom and stuff. I do think it's being well made. It's, you know, the first one was very well made too.
Mari, how about you? How many magnifying glasses will you give this episode?
I think for the episode itself, just focusing on The Jinx Part 2, Episode 1, not getting caught up in the nostalgia of The Jinx Part 1, I will definitely say 4. I think that this is a strong reintroduction to the world of The Jinx and the case. And I think I'm going to give it a 4 right now, because looking at another five episodes, I don't know, Sarah. You know, we've had properties that have started off really, really well. And then they try and stretch to just 3 episodes, and it's like, this doesn't deserve 3. So I'm very apprehensive about how they're going to stretch this to an additional 5. So I'll give it 4, because I think it start off strong. I think this is definitely going to pull people in. I think Discovery and Max knew exactly what they're doing, dropping this in their prime crime spot of Sundays at 9 p.m. They love doing this now. I actually like that I know when to look at Max for like my true crime fix. So they know what they're doing. And I think they're trying to catch lightning in a bottle again, but it's going to be hard to follow up. How about you, Sarah? How many magnifying glasses are you going to rate The Jinx Part 2?
Yes, so Part 2, Episode 1, so noted, only Episode 1. I'm also going to give it a 4. I think it's well made. I'm so interested in the case. Mari, you and I don't like properties where the perpetrator gets a lot of attention and gets to talk to the camera. This would be an exception. When I was rewatching Part 1, I thought, oh, yeah, that's right, Mari, and I don't like this. Mm-hmm. But there's something so fundamental about, like, you cannot understand the case if you don't understand or at least regard or sit in the presence of Bobby Durst for at least some amount of time.
Yeah, it's a rope and, one, you know, where they're giving them just enough rope.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give it a 4 for the first episode. Mari, you and I will give a mini review in 5 weeks' time when the rest of it has dropped and we've watched the rest of it. And Sarah, we might solicit your final opinion after.
I was hoping you would.
So Sarah, why don't you tell us about some of the work you've been doing, particularly why can't we talk about Amanda's mum?
Well, thank you for asking. So Why Can't We Talk About Amanda's Mom is an 8-part investigative podcast series that it was released last year, February of 2023, over, you know, 8 weeks. And it covers about 3 years of time following my investigation into a cold case homicide in Mobile, Alabama, that took place in 1993. And it was the victim was a woman named Renee Bergeron, and her daughter, Amanda. Obviously, I spend a lot of time with her. She's how I kind of came to know the victim a lot better. It is a case where the original case, I believe, went cold for the same reason that many, if not most of them do, which was that she was a member of a marginalized community. She was a sometimes sex worker. And she was regarded by investigators at the time as, you know, quote unquote, a crack whore. And so kind of, you know, and they did a lot of work, but they did a lot of, in my opinion, very, very, very bad work based around their assumptions based on this like bullet point thing that they had about her. And so it follows the sort of roller coaster of the investigation. It is a crazy whodunit crime with some very interesting, you know, suspects and stuff. But the larger issue is, you know, what we're doing when we don't actually get to know the victims as investigators, but it's also an issue in the media. If we don't really get to know the victim, we're going to start in directions based on assumptions. And those directions are never, ever going to lead us anywhere but to a dead end. And like I said, this is why I feel like I have so many cold cases. Why Can't We Talk About Amanda's Mom follows that. But it is, like I said, it's a pretty interesting case. And I think people, even if you're not in it for the, like, you know, me bitching about, you know, about unfair investigations, to just be in it for the mystery of it. And I've been embedded with the Mobile County Sheriff's Department, the major crimes unit, for 5 years now. I actually work with them regularly on a number of their cold cases. They're an incredible agency who I think is doing things right now. They were not, you know, 30 years ago when this case happened, but they are now. They're very invested in the community. They have a good relationship with the community. And so I think it highlights some real problems in policing, but it highlights like some ways that we can do it better as well. On top of just being this like crazy case of what happened to this incredible woman who was literally and figuratively discarded. And I'm working on, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say. We're working on a new case that may or may not be in development as a podcast as well.
Oh, intriguing. Intriguing.
Look at you.
It's very interesting, that idea of investigators getting an idea ahead of the investigation and going with it. I mean, just to go back to the Jinx part one briefly, the non-investigation of Kathy Durst's disappearance, partly it speaks to the privilege of the Durst family, money, white man privilege. But also we have an investigator interviewed and saying, well, you know, I mean, maybe she shacked up with someone else. It happens all the time. I was so shocked because I thought, yeah, it doesn't happen all the time.
It doesn't ever happen. That she just vanished from the whole family. Yeah, no, that does not happen.
It does not happen. It's the same here when Aboriginal children go missing and the police, they're better now, but the police say, oh, they've gone walkabout. No, they haven't. They're urban children who are missing. They did not run away. So I think that's fascinating, and I can't wait to listen, because yeah, that whole idea of starting from assumption, as you say, will always lead to a dead end.
Always, every time.
Just add it to my phone right now. I was like, let me do that right now, because I forget things.
I'll remind you. Mm-hmm. At Crime Scene, where you get to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes, you can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP, that's Scene S-E-E-N, or email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com.
We're on TikTok at crime.scene and on all other social media platforms at Crime Scene Podcast. And please remember to subscribe to our feed by going to robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. It makes a big difference.
It sure does. So, Sarah, what do you have going on, and where can the people find you?
Well, like I said, I am up to my eyeballs in a new cold case right now, a cold case out of Kansas. That is one that has kind of lived rent-free in my head since I first heard about it in 2016. I was in that region looking into another case that would become the Hell in the Heartland documentary series. So you can find me there too. But I'm right now just like primarily working on investigating this case. And we ran into something of an evidence emergency. And so I am very unexpectedly getting on a plane Sunday morning to go back down to Kansas and try and find a knife. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, you can find me primarily on socials these days. I have largely absented myself from Twitter, but you can find me on Instagram at just my name backwards, Kaylin Sarah. That's me on Instagram, and that's the best place to find me and follow me and get updates on cases and stuff like that. And hit me up. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff.
Fantastic. Amazing. Mari, what about you? What have you got going on? And where can people find you?
I know, right? Wrestling Wrap Up is on hiatus. Of course, me and Matt Scott have wrapped up our coverage of WrestleMania, the road to WrestleMania. We had so much fun. If you haven't listened to our experience at WrestleMania in Philly a few weeks ago, you can definitely go check us out by going to robhasawebsite.com/wrestlingfeed or going to our YouTube page, youtube.com/@WrestlingRehapUp. That's at wrestling RHAPUP. You can find me over on the Recap Kickback. Me and Chappelle are having a blast having so many guests. I have about one more over there on the Recap Kickback before I go on maternity leave. We did it so you didn't have to. We watched the American Society of Magical Negroes and had an in-depth discussion on how we felt the film depicted magical Black people. Me, Chappelle, and Latanya joined forces again to discuss a very, very controversial movie that you can't even find in theaters anymore. That's how backlashy it got. So definitely go check out the Recap Kickback. You can go to recapkickback.com. Or you can go to youtube.com/@recapkickback. It's so fun. We are having all sorts of discussions over there about everything. So go subscribe while I'm out. Chappelle has a whole bunch of fun guests coming up. So just make sure you're subscribed. And of course, you can find me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two. No matter what, I will be on Twitter. I can be out and still tweet. So that's where you can find me. Sarah, what about you? What are you up to and where can people find you?
Well, people can follow me on X, formerly Twitter.
Never calling it
Twitter. That. It's always going to be Twitter. At Sarah Carradine. I'm all over silent podcasts, reality TV, out the wazoo. I'm covering Alone Australia season 2 with the great Annabelle Fiddler, and I'm covering Taskmaster UK season 17 with Naomi Calhoun. My latest project is with a comedian and Taskmaster task writer and faithful traitor person, Sam Smith. We are watching The Traitors Quebec. Neither of us speak French, so we are just trying to untangle what's going on. He has played The Traitors. I've watched The Traitors. We think we know what we're doing in a show called What Did They Francais? So find us over there. If you speak French, or indeed if you are in that show, please add us with everything we got wrong. If indeed anything, like we might have it exactly right. Who knows? Mari, what's happening over the next few weeks?
Like I said, I will be going on maternity leave, but our official third chair, Sarah D. Bunting, will be stepping up. Thanks, SDB. You and Sarah, you got the reins now, so woo-hoo. Don't crash.
Okay.
Yeah, you have the keys. Yeah, yeah.
We've got quite a few things set up, some interesting and exciting things, as always. Next time on Crime Scene, so Sarah and I will be covering the scripted series Under the Bridge. Watch it on Hulu and send us your comments and questions. Thank you, Mari, for 102 incredible episodes. You'll be missed until you return. Thanks so much to Sarah Kalin. Your debut, but hopefully the first of many appearances here on the scene. Thanks to Will from America for the theme music and the whole RHAP team behind the scenes. Until next time. Okay. Bye bye. Case closed.